Welcome to K-Chung Radio. You're listening to Performance Now. This is John. Carol is out sick, but I am here with Edgar Arsenault. Welcome.
Thank you.
And we are here at the Beta Main Museum on Main. And we're here because this coming Friday, Inauguration Day, there will be a screening of Edgar's piece Until that will be at LACMA at 7:30, and we thought it'd be good to speak with you to talk about the piece since it seemed like so kind of to be so germane and touch on so many relevant issues at the moment. And maybe one way to start is if you could say a little about what is it that people are going to be seeing? What is
Yeah,
until?
and we should also mention that it's free and open to the public.
Okay.
So for the listeners out there that want to attend, just get there at 7 o'clock and grab a seat. So Until is based on a performance that Ben Vereen did in 1981, which was done at Ronald Reagan's inaugural gala. And the performance was a tribute to the vaudevillian performer Burt Williams, who was one of the most popular American performers at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century. So like the late 1800s, early 1900s, he performed in blackface. And Ben Vereen had learned about him late in life and was moved and decided that he wanted to take this tribute to Ronald Reagan and all these Republicans, as a way of reminding them of the plight of artists, of African Americans, of African American performers, in hopes that that the humanity of the piece would, to some degree, have some positive effect on Ronald Reagan's policies. But what Ben didn't know was that the second half of the performance that contained the critique was edited out by ABC. And only the first part was aired, which, presented Ben as doing a minstrel show for Ronald Reagan and George Bush and 20,000 white Republicans. And the backlash was immense. So, the irony of it was that the very community that Ben went there to represent were the people that turned on him the most. You know, I mean, the. He got death threats, people spit in his face when he's walking down the street. I mean, it was.
I was reading some of the responses to his performance at the time, and one of them was like very like, next time I see you, it'll be behind a rifle or something like that. It was pretty loaded, so to say, the response.
And there's something to be said about the courage that it takes to put, your what's considered to be one culture shame on display, right? Because from Ben's perspective, having had numerous conversations with him, though maybe we might be jumping ahead in the story here, but his perspective was that these performers, they did the buffoonery so we could build the universities. These were the folks that were some of our early philanthropists, and they did the kind of work that they could get, and they were super talented, and we shouldn't be ashamed of them.
Because Burt Williams was one of the like earliest African Americans to have such levels of success as a performer, right?
That's right. Yeah, he could sing, he could act. I mean, in a lot of ways, Ben saw a he saw his, this direct connection to this figure that he had no idea existed. And was profoundly moved to hear his story. But part of the reason why I wanted to write this piece was because I realized that to some degree what Ben had performed on that stage had also become his life. So sort of like the tragedy that happens on the stage to some degree happens to him in his personal life as well.
But that, okay, so let's maybe step back a little. So that's the story of Ben Vereen on which your performance and the piece that kind of results from it is based.
That's right, yeah.
So what happens is that in 2015, you decide to restage Ben Vereen, restaging in some ways Burt Williams.
Yeah, the original intention was to create a scenario where Ben himself could perform the 10 minutes that he had intended, but circumstances didn't allow for that to happen.
Oh, so originally you were going to have him redo... Wow, okay.
Yeah, originally he was in it. I mean, when I went to him, you know, I'd written the piece around, you know, this idea that, you know, the part of the burden of doing this thing and being misunderstood was that now he's 70 years old, and, you know, you can... A dancer's body is their tool, you know, that tool may dull, but they can still, I mean, like when Ben performs, I mean, he's still Ben Vereen, like he's still amazing. So I wanted to show that version from him in 1981 performing alongside himself today was part of the original idea.
Yeah.
But you know, he and I met in 2014. So in the spring of 2014, so we, had numerous conversations before he wasn't able to do the piece any longer. But it was actually, it was one of those situations where after about a week or two, you know, him leaving the piece, you know, you realize that like there's this, all these other avenues of opportunity makes themselves available to tell the story in a way that I might not have been able to do if he was in it.
Yeah, because, okay, let's, I mean, so when he performed his, you know, his critique, it was 1981, you were still a kid at that point. And in fact, you didn't encounter it until, you know, 10 years, some, like 10 plus years later, right, when you were... By then, kind of...
97.
Just finished school.
Yeah, 97, 98 is when I came across it. And, you know, I'll just tell you a little bit about my story. So I grew up in L.A. My mother was born here. My father's from Texas, so he met my mother in Oakland and, you know, moved to L.A. and married her.
Yeah.
And my mother's father, whom I'm named after, is from Mississippi, so he migrated here in the
20s.
Yeah. So, you know, like a lot of African-Americans at the time after Jim Crow, you know, they were like, let's get out of here. And my grandfather did that. My father did it, you know, a generation or so later. But, you know, before I went to art school, I didn't even know what contemporary art was. I mean, you know, I would see.
Really?
I had no real sense of what the history was, though I most certainly had a sense of what the content was, right? I just didn't understand, like, you know, the theoretical, the historical, all the kind of underpinnings of thought that goes along with it. But, you know, when I got into art school, you know, I remember, you know, going through like this existential crisis in my undergrad because, you know, my professor had asked me this really simple question, which was, you know, what is your work about? And I remember at that point, up until that point, because I was at Art Center, I found my way into Art Center through a series of coincidences and chance encounters. And here I was thinking that, you know, artist was about having a style and, you know, if you have an apple in front of you, you know how to draw an apple really well.
Yeah.
But, you know, him asking me that question kind of tore open this whole universe because I was like, well, what do you mean? What is it about? But it brought me back to some of my earlier experiences with my grandfather, which I find myself talking about often as of late, because he is, you know, I'm named after him, and he was an artist, and he was an inventor, but, you know, he died 2 months before I was born. But the thing that was kind of, was interesting to me is that, and I've come back to it over the years, is that people say I walk like him, I look like him, I talk like him, right? So I was sort of, it was kind of like, it was really my introduction into conceptual thought, but also into metaphysics and kind of philosophical, or at least at the time, as I was growing up as a Catholic, into sort of religious thinking, like there was some kind of something magical, spiritual about this idea, like that you could be,
you were connected to your grandma,
that I would be connected to a person that I never met. And like, mm-hmm. so how do you rectify that paradox, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as I started to understand how conceptual thinking worked, then it also opened me up to think about like political thoughts and political gestures and mm-hmm. how those things relate or somehow how they don't. But at the same time, you know, if getting an art education, you also get this, you get this impression that there's certain kinds of tendencies within the education, which is like, hey, you're a black artist, you should be dealing with identity based issues.
Yeah.
And I was not interested in that. Mm-hmm. I was more interested in this question of like, how could two things be the same thing at the same time, right? My interests were more epistemological in nature. Like mm-hmm. I was more inclined to wonder about why we would, you know, describe something as being black when it actually doesn't have that color in it at all, right? It's sort of like more mm-hmm. like the questioning the nature of the question,
yeah,
in a way.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I came across this Ben Vereen performance, you know, a few years out of school, you know, I had had a drawing practice that I had been, you know, creating on my own. And, you know, I was sort of squarely in my own space outside of being around teachers and making assignments and stuff. You know, I was kind of, and, you know, this became this, you know, me happening upon this documentary had a big impact on me, mainly because I couldn't reconcile it. Like I was like, you know, this thing is beautiful, it's amazing, but like, why is he doing blackface like that? To me, I completely moralized it at the time. I was like, man, this is, mm-hmm. you know, like, what was he thinking, you know? But at the same time, I was like, it's really beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And then what's he doing with Ronald Reagan? Like, well, you know, but part of the reason also why I couldn't reconcile is because I couldn't find the video footage. Mm-hmm. Again, like it was, you know, every few years I would think about it and I'd be like, what happened with that? And I'd search on YouTube once that was invented mm-hmm. and it wasn't there. And we just assume everything is on the internet, but that video doesn't exist there.
Yeah. So that really stayed with you in, you know, the 20 some years that you, between the time you saw it.
It did stay with me. Not in a way in which it was like the lens by which I saw the world, but mm-hmm. it definitely sat on the shelf as like some kind of a very profound experience that, you know, I just wasn't able to put it away.
Yeah. Yeah. And in the intervening time, you know, you develop your practice for which you're known, and you know, you're a very multimedia interdisciplinary artist. You work in, you know, you've definitely have a practice in drawing that you were mentioning, but then you also make installations, you make sculptural objects. But this was actually your first performance piece, right?
Yeah, yeah. So, outside of like the one performance art class that I took in undergrad at Art uh-huh. Center. Yeah, it was the first one. And, you know, part of the reason that I was invited to do this performance by a performer was because I don't do performance. I mean, that's their mm-hmm. tradition, is to invite people to bring other aspects of their practice into the space of durational something.
Yeah.
But, you know, my experience has been that I haven't seen very many performances that I consider to be all that memorable.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot, and you know, in some instances, you know, I would see performances and I would be like, couldn't you just say that? Like, why are we being put through this?
Uh-huh.
you know, like, could you just write that down?
Uh-huh. You must have interesting conversations with performers.
I don't know all that many, but you know, I mean, the performers that I do know,
mm-hmm.
Consider to be performance as an extension of a number of other kinds of inquiries, you know, like mm-hmm. Rodney McMillan does performance,
yeah,
but he does performance for video sometimes, really, you know, but he's, you know, it extends from his certain core ideas that are connected to painting.
Yeah.
Or, you know, Andrea Bowers, who and Suzanne Lacey did a performance here at the Beta Main as their opening show. And that was Suzanne teaching Andrea how to do performance. So, like, but, you know, Andrea makes drawings. She's not really a performance person. So, like, that's kind of the circle of people that are kind of orbit around me with performances. Like, it's not something which is that they consider to be core and sacred to the, who they are. So it's okay for me to have a certain contempt for performance art. But, you know, I also have a certain contempt for musicals, too, but I wound up making that, too.
Yeah.
So there is something to be said about, you know, being attracted to the things that you told yourself that you are not, right? And it's a way of pushing up against or breaking through your own taboos. Because, you know, you're just like, yeah, I'll never do that. And I said that about blackface. I was like, you know, there were many artists that were dealing with that subject matter. Okay, so I went to school in the 90s.
Yeah.
So, you know, Glenn Ligon, you know, Lorna Simpson, Kerry James Marshall, Daniel Martinez, you know, Kara Walker, it was becoming, you know, a thing in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
And, you know, all of these artists whose works that I respected seemed like they were doing a pretty good job mapping out an inquiry into the legacy of colonialism. Mm-hmm. You know, the neuroses that was produced by slavery and racism. And I respected those practices, but it was something that I didn't want to do. It wasn't something that I wanted to take on directly, which is part of the reason why Charles Gaines and I became so close, because his inquiries into power and structure were more rooted in understanding the limitations of language and the way in which certain tendencies or certain power dynamics can be reinforced by the paradigms that we use. Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like, I remember when he said to me, you know, blackness is generally understood as the absence of whiteness, right? So it doesn't have any autonomy. When you think of blackness and whiteness as being dualities.
Yeah. A binary.
Yeah, binaries. But when you get rid of the binary, then it opens things up to sort of break through. But, you know, part of my kind of my market critique was that even though these artists were, you know, having great success critically, but I also realized that to some degree, like, you could get trapped in a place, and I hesitate to say this just because it may come across as being kind of painting with a broad brush, but I didn't want to be trapped in making any one kind of work, and I didn't want to find myself in a situation where I might be trying to, like, sell my misery, you know, as art. Because, you know, the market wants to do that. The market turns things into units so that it can regularize it. And
it gives you an identity. Yeah.
And yeah, so part of the reason why I've shifted my techniques and my materials, but it's for two reasons. One is because I think that if you want to know if an idea, if a core set of ideas hold any real truth to them, then you have to test them in different contexts. You have to try it in different materials, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of a scientific method approach in a way. And then also because my temperament is just like, I just get tired of doing the same thing over and over again. You know? Like, I like the difference.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was like, well, can you build a career doing that? Like, can you make drawings and then your next show be films? And I said, well, I don't know, but I better start setting that track record now. You know, so like 10 years from now, if I change, you know, people will be looking not for a look, but but an approach, like a way of doing things.
Yeah.
And I've tried to maintain that because I think that it's allowed me a certain malleability and flexibility, but it's also expanded my community and friends and social relationships and critical relationships pretty extensively. I don't know if I was talking too much.
No, I mean, yeah, it's interesting that, you know, you're saying, like, in some ways, I think that that was some, that seems to be a sentiment that's shared by many artists, I think, who came of age at that moment, who, you know, could see, like, the kind of the identity politics thing coming, but then also were very wary of it and wanting to kind of not get stuck in some ways, right?
Yeah, because that was what I was being pushed towards in my education, which I resented. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Charles was that one person who didn't do that. And mm-hmm. he sort of opened my eyes up. And I mean, he came and taught at Art Center when I was a student there, which is the reason why I got to Cal Arts, is because he said, hey, why don't you come to graduate school?
Yeah.
And my joke with him is that I told him around the time, I was like, oh, real artists don't go to grad school. Mm-hmm. And he was like, what the fuck? What are you talking about? You know? Uh-huh. And anyway, so 3 years later, I was there. With him, mm-hmm. but anyway, that big digression was just to say that, you know, even though I found that performance by Ben Vereen to be so moving, I had pretty much stated early on that I would never do anything with that subject matter. So, you know, I was interested in it, but
when
I never
you say that subject matter
with blackface and that, uh-huh. the legacy of that. Mm-hmm. Because the way in which I had experienced it almost in every instance was a kind of through a moral lens. Like, you know, look at how shameful a situation that we're in because we're still in blackface now. Like, you know, these kinds of stories, which I don't find to be generally true. Mm-hmm. And I don't find them in most instances to be specifically true.
Yeah.
But it is a popular way of treating the subject, and I was like, well, okay. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when I was invited to do this commission, I was at this kid's birthday party. Mm-hmm.
The performa piece took place in November 2015.
But I was invited to do something in 2013.
Okay.
Early 2014. Mm-hmm. Maybe January, February, somewhere in the spring.
Uh-huh.
And I thought that I had an idea. So it was curator Adrian Edwards, who had invited me. And,
mm-hmm. So you're at a birthday party for
a kid that I wasn't invited to. And, you know, I'm standing in line mm-hmm. at the, you know, trying to stand in line for a hot dog.
Uh-huh.
And a little bothered because the line is moving super slow.
Uh-huh.
And I look over and I'm kind of scanning the crowd like you do at a party. And, you know, I see sitting at the bar is Ben Vereen.
Uh-huh.
I was like, oh, that's interesting. Ben Vereen is sitting there.
Uh-huh.
And then it dawns on me. I was like, oh, my God. Uh-huh. That performance that you saw. Like,
yeah.
And then I was like, wait, I'm working on it. I've been commissioned to do a performance. Like, maybe this means something.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I left the line and I went down and I talked to him. And he mm-hmm. was incredibly gracious and very welcoming. I was like, you know, Mr. Vereen, you don't know me. I'm a big fan of yours.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, oh, thanks, man. You know, he shook mm-hmm. my hand. You know, it's like, you know. But if you don't mind, I just wanted to ask you about this performance that you did in 1980, uh-huh. you know, that Ronald Reagan.
Did he, like, lock up? Like,
yeah, and he was just like, yeah, I could see that something, it was subtle enough for me to realize that that I had struck a nerve, but I didn't understand why. Because
uh-huh.
I didn't know any of the backstory about what had happened to him as a repercussion of that.
Yeah.
All I knew is that I saw it and I was moved by it and perplexed by it.
Uh-huh.
And just wanted to know more.
Yeah.
And
for our listeners, maybe just to give a little kind of backstory of Ben Vereen's backstory, just in case they're not familiar with him. I mean, he's a kind of a very well-known African-American actor and performer who actually was in Roots in the 70s in the miniseries. And then he already had a certain reputation as a kind of a, you know, well-known performer.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he had won a Tony on Broadway for his role in Pippin, mm-hmm. Bob Fosse's Pippin. So, you know, he was known as a triple threat. He could sing, he could dance, he could act. And, you know, he was beautiful and people loved him. And, you know, he was really at that, you know, right at the height of his prowess and popularity.
Yeah. And then he does this.
And then he does this on,
And then ABC cuts out the part of his performance that's really, you know, was meant as a kind of a critique.
Yeah.
And his career immediately, like, suffers a setback because mm-hmm. of this.
I mean, not forever.
Uh-huh.
So, you mean he does, you know, he does have other roles. He's got TV shows and things that comes after.
Yeah.
But what I realized when I eventually did have the meeting with him, which just to finish that part of the story.
Yeah.
So, you know, I said, you know, if you'd be open to it, I would love to meet with you. And he said, well, you can ask my daughter.
Uh-huh.
Oh. And that's when I realized that his daughter was Karan Davis, and Noah Davis's wife. I was at the Underground Museum down in Lafayette Square. Oh, no. Well, what neighborhood is that? Not too far from where we are right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this beautiful, you know, art center that he started with his brother, Khalil, and his wife. And the birthday party was their son, Moses, you know. Mm-hmm. And I was with Henry Taylor and Andrea Bowers, and they brought me along because I had carpooled with them earlier that day.
Yeah.
So, you know, I wasn't even supposed to be there.
Mm-hmm.
But he said, well, you know, so his daughter said, so Karan said, well, listen, I'll call you and I'll tell you the rest of the story.
Oh.
You know the rest. And that's when we talked, and then she explained it to me. And she goes, well, you know, but I talked to my dad, you know, and I told him that you were one of the good ones and that, you know, you could be trusted and that he should meet with you.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, thank you. And, you know, maybe 2-3 weeks later, I'm driving down this sedate, you know, upper middle class neighborhood to Ben's house.
Yeah.
You know, and he welcomes me at the door and we sit down and talk. And then that's when I recognized that he had been carrying this wound for all this time.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah. Because he had been trying to make it, he had wanted to make an intervention that would kind of be able to use blackface in a way that would open it up for discussion, and it kind of backfired in some ways.
Well, you know, I think the discussion part of it is really the, that's where the challenge is, because even if you see the full performance, the full 10 minutes, even then it's super moving, there's still a part of most people that they say, well, it is pretty good, but why would he do that anyway, right?
Yeah.
And that was the reason why I wanted to make a piece from his performance of Nobody, was that it sits in the way in which, you know, great art does, is that it constantly forces you to reorient yourself to it, you know? So, like, you know, we're at this really challenging moment where, you know, Donald Trump has been elected president and, you know, it shattered in many ways our ideas of who we are as a nation and where we're going as a country. And, you know, I'm asking myself which performer would be willing to go on stage and do anything that would be, you know, a kind of a critical engagement with this administration. Who would do that? But, you know, and that's, it's in some strange way, I mean, the piece now resonates in a way in which I could not imagine that it would. But I don't really take much solace in that reality. And that being the condition of it. And what I mean by that is that, you know, the election could have gone in some other direction, and then some other set of projects or art projects would have become relevant in that way.
Yeah.
So this just happened to align.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe, you know, by saying just happened, maybe that's not exactly it either. But to some degree, I think that artists, creative people, creative endeavors, oftentimes are riding the ebb and flow of the zeitgeist at the moment. And that zeitgeist is a kind of timescape that is connected to all of these different events in the past, the present, and where things could be going in the future. And to some degree, you know, I've built an art practice that's, you know, in more ways than one, been influenced by chance meetings just like this, you know. And they produce these interesting relationships with the moment that we're in. Sometimes that doesn't happen until 3-4 years into the future. But I think, you know, you sort of like, if you try to stay in tune with, I don't know exactly how to describe it, to be honest, but, you know, we know, you know, musicians and the people who don't necessarily consider themselves to be political in the sense that they're trying to kind of speak to power, but somehow they've just sort of part of that so inextricably kind of within the fabric of that time.
Yeah. But there's something really interesting. So, I mean, okay, so let's go back to that meeting with Ben Vereen, the first one and then the second one, right? In which, you know, he agrees to meet with you, and presumably you get to see the footage again for the first time since you saw it in the 90s, and this time you see all of it. And so there you are, you know, you're an African-American artist, he's an African-American performer, actor, triple threat, as you were calling him, both very well known in, you know, your respective fields, with at that time, you know, an African-American president sitting in the White House, yeah, right? And who had started his tenure, you know, with this, you know, with this almost feel of post-race, yes, right? And by that point in time, I think that had really kind of dissolved, or that illusion had kind of been shattered in some ways. And so you're kind of watching this together, you know, when he's kind of at that moment when he was performing for Reagan, right? And there's something, I mean, how did it feel at that moment? Like,
this is just a, adjust that. I mean, what you're describing right now is a very compelling picture, and most certainly, you know, at that, by the time, you know, 2014 has come around, mm-hmm, you know the yes we can, you know, believe in hope mantra,
yeah,
had already become tattered at the edges,
yeah, right?
Like we'd already seen what our government was capable of, mm-hmm, and how much opposition Obama's vision for the country it had, and also, you know, some of our disappointments that we had with him as a president too.
Yeah.
So yeah, we most certainly were never in a post-racial society, and I don't think that that's anything that he ever advocated for. But just to kind of like add another layer of complication to that story, what Ben showed me wasn't the 1981 version of the performance.
Oh, it wasn't.
He had performed it before. Mm-hmm. As on the road for at least a year. Mm-hmm. So this is the reason why he decided to do it here, is because it had already been kind of tested,
yeah,
on, you know, in different smaller venues. But he did this one as part of an award show for comedians, which is also strange. So it was a slightly different version than what I had remembered.
Uh-huh.
But what had happened was that I said, well, you know, can I see the video? And he said, you know, well, let me, I don't have that one, but I have this version. And
he sat on the floor. So he didn't have that footage.
He didn't have it either.
Oh.
I actually wound up bringing, when I got hold of it, taking it to him to see it for the first time in like 30 years.
Wow.
So, you know, he put it on and he sat down on the floor in front of me, and the TV was in front of him. So I'm sitting behind him, watching him watch himself from, you know, 30 plus years before.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, he's making these comments like, oh man, look at me, you know, look at my body, like look at those high kicks, like, you know, uh-huh, look at what I used to be able to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, and at this point, you know, he's 70 years old, you know, his body is, you know, not what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I just saw this like alignment of windows.
Yeah.
Right? Because mm-hmm, Ben Vereen performing Burt Williams, you know, it's like 100 years ago.
Yeah.
From the moment in which we're at.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the question became like, well, when did this performance start?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, and when did it end? Because in his, through the conversation, I realized that it was still very much going on.
Yeah.
But as a trauma inside of his, mm-hmm, you know, his body, you know. And I actually wound up turning that into one of the scenes in the play, was mm-hmm, that meeting that I had sitting with him and watching,
yeah,
him watch himself.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, after he told me the whole story, and this is the part of how funny, how life works. After he told me the story of what happened, how all of his friends, like, you know, Jesse Jackson,
mm-hmm,
Ruby Dee, Ozzie mm-hmm Davis, Frank Sinatra, Johnny Carson, you know, like these are all the people that were either directly in his immediate circle or people that were in the room when he did the performance that night.
Yeah.
And he said all of them just stopped talking to him immediately or came really? Out against him in public.
Wow. Uh-huh.
Sammy Davis Jr. was another one who came out mm-hmm. against him. Johnny Carson, who he had like on speed dial, wouldn't take his calls. He's like, Johnny, yeah. just let me come on the show so I can explain what happened.
Yeah, and he had introduced him that night, right?
He did. He yeah. did. And he had been on Johnny Carson's show before then. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Jesse Jackson, all of them, you know. Mm-hmm. So what he said is he felt like, you know, someone had pulled a plug out of my heart.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
But when he was describing to me the story, what he didn't know mm-hmm. was that I had had, to a lesser degree, mm-hmm. My own experience with being, you know, publicly shamed in the press because of the work that I was doing down at Watts with Watts House Project.
'Cause, yeah.
You know, when I resigned from that organization in 2012, mm-hmm. I had directly experienced my very own community coming out against me and the work that we were doing down at Watts. Not because what we were doing was wrong, was because they weren't doing it,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And I had never experienced that kind of, you know, destructive mentality, kind of scorched the earth,
mm-hmm.
Kind of sensibility from other organizational leaders
yeah.
ever in my life. And these were other African Americans, you know?
Yeah.
And it changed me in a kind of profound way, but it also deeply hurt me,
mm-hmm.
You know, to be maligned in the way in which we were,
mm-hmm.
especially knowing that the work that we were doing was having very positive effects.
Mm-hmm.
And that I wasn't even taking a salary, right? Like I was a volunteer,
mm-hmm.
And, you know, raising damn near $1 million for this neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when I wound up leaving the organization, you know, it took me at least 3 years to recover from that, just kind of emotionally and also financially, you
mm-hmm.
know, because, you know, I was making a living selling drawings, you know,
yeah.
and I was making less art because I was spending more time down working in this organization.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to kind of to see, like, people that you think are your friends and then, you know, they're repeating the same stuff that they've heard without even asking you, you know, sort mm-hmm. of being judged in this way.
Yeah.
So it sort of gave me an additional insight, but also it allowed me the opportunity to exercise those demons, right? To mm-hmm. like, to take that experience and turn it into something that could be transformative for someone else,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
As well as for myself. So when I was given this opportunity to do this thing and Ben said, okay, you know, let's do it.
Yeah.
You know, they said, but you just have to promise to protect me.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you know, I can't let this happen. That can't happen to me again.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I was like, oh my God, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's make sure that doesn't happen to you. But I was like, also like, let's make sure that doesn't happen to me either.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Which is how I decided to write. Part of the reason why I decided to write the script in the mm-hmm. way in which it was written, and it was me and my writing partner Kurt Foreman,
mm-hmm.
That you know we sculpted it so that the story slowly unfolds
mm-hmm.
and pushes the symbol of the blackface out of the middle and pushes it to the periphery.
Hmm. Okay. It's interesting, you know, like that you're talking about this coming at a moment in your own career when there's, you know, some, I don't know, hesitance or just kind of feeling of alienation maybe. And it's clear that, you know, he was alienated, Vereen was alienated from his community because of this, because of what he had done. And so your kind of way of tackling this was to, in some ways, to do something which had carried some risk, right? I mean, for both of you.
Yeah.
And to do it as a performance, as a live stage thing, rather than to do, you know, in the way that you were more accustomed, right. which is to make an artwork about it.
Yeah.
You know, so that was carried some challenges, right?
Yeah.
With it.
It did, but also it was one of those situations where you're like, hey, just put everything that you ever wanted to do and you've told yourself that you should hold back, or, you know, just put it all in there. Like, don't, you know, because, you know, I said, I was like, if it's gonna go down and be bad, like, let it go out in, like, the brightest blaze of glory as possible, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, the play itself, which from performance standpoint, like, you know, they're like, we don't do theater, we do performance. And I'm like, okay, well, there is a performance inside of a play. How about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I'd, like I said earlier, you know, I did not at that time have a very, my experience with performance wasn't a very positive one. It's not to say that I hadn't seen any good performances, but it wasn't, you know, something that I went back and was like, okay, I'm going to follow this person's career. And, you know, which I mean, I never worked in that way anyway, but but I decided to write the story in a way that made sense, but also that it can reconcile some of the issues that I think dealing with historical subjects often brings with it that can be, that can kind of turn it into something sentimental. So, you know, my one of my fundamental beliefs is that history never comes back the same. Right? It's always an entirely new thing. It just kind of looks like the past. So, you know, Donald Trump most certainly is not Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
But Ronald Reagan's policies and free market capitalism, you know, produced the conditions for Donald Trump to become, you know, the billionaire that he is today, right? And exploit all the loopholes and all the deregulation and all the things that were happening during that time period.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, how do I deal with that with this story? And I said, well, the way in which we're going to do that is by telling the story not from the historical perspective, but from how Ben remembers it, right? Which is as a series of traumatic events, a series of traumas. But also, you know, based on this mantra that, you know, everyone and everything in my dreams is me. So, yeah, there's a real Ronald Reagan, there's a real George Bush. But after 30 years, you know, those things become vessels for the projections of our own psychology, our own fears.
You know, yeah.
So what I did is when we were writing the show was to have the actor Frank Lawson, who's, you know, incredible in the role, play all the male performers in the show. He plays the bartender in the beginning of the show. He plays Ben Vereen. He plays Ben Vereen playing Burt Williams. He's Donny Osmond. The only male that he doesn't occupy is Ronald Reagan. So when we wrote the script and, you know, when I directed it, I really tried to tell it as if you were inside of somebody's mind.
Yeah.
You know, so when you move from one scene to the next, everything moves very fluidly. And what most audience members didn't realize was that the play had already started 15 minutes before the curtain had opened. Like, they didn't realize that the actor, that the person who was serving them their drinks at the bar was the actor who was going, when the curtain pulled back and then there he was. And they're like, oh, wait a minute. Like, you know, was that the guy who was just behind the... So the audience becomes like a... The audience thinks that they're, in the beginning of the show, the audience thinks that they're there to observe the performance. But by the end of the show, what happens is that they realize that they are the central subject of the show. And that's by, like, just slowly drawing them in more and more until they are, like, literally on stage.
Yeah, so it's kind of like a mirror being held back to them in some ways.
Not a mirror, but more like, you know, this idea that you can never go home again, right? So the curtain in this show is used as a kind of fourth wall, which in this instance, because it was about a television broadcast that never was a television signal that was never broadcast. for the first half of the show, you're seeing it from the perspective of, like, if you were in your living room watching the TV.
Yeah.
And then for the last half of the show, you're on the other side of that curtain, in very close proximity to each other and with the actor on the stage.
Yeah.
And, you know, without kind of ruining it for the viewers, it's very effective in a way in which I had hoped that it would be, but I wasn't certain if it would work, but it does something in a way which kind of, you realize that you, to some degree, that's you inside of that building in 1981. Like, mm-hmm. we all become inculcated within this story.
Yeah. Well, there's something, there's something, you know, interesting about the way that you stage the performance, right? Because, I think one of the tropes about performance as a medium, as a genre, is that it's very immediate. It's about the now, it's about the present. And this performance is, on the one hand, it's not about the present because it's about this memory of something that happened in 1981, which is itself a kind of an homage to something, you know, or someone that existed, you know, decades earlier, right? It's about these two moments, then, you know, 1981 and the memory of that moment, but then also that moment itself carries a memory of someone else or the history of someone else from the start of the 20th century, you know, who hadn't even, Ben-Vereen never actually saw him or had any kind of contact with this person. It was kind of an imagining of that person, right? There are records of similar things that he maybe performed. So, you know, I guess Ben-Vereen performs at the start of his performance Waiting for the Robert E. Lee, right? Mm-hmm. And in preparation for our talk, I saw on YouTube, you know, Judy Garland doing that performance. And it's just in 1941. And it's really kind of mind-blowing even to see that in 1941 it was being performed as this kind of, you know, like...
It's a very popular song.
Yeah.
And I can understand why people would want to sing it because it's very catchy.
Yeah.
You know, it tells a story and, it plays well for a certain section audiences that want, you know, who lament for that time of cotton steamships going up and down the Mississippi River. But, you know, Ben's performance actually in itself is a loop. Mm-hmm. So in the beginning of his performance, he reads from this book. In my performance, he reads from a book. It's called Nobody, and the words go like this: there's got to be somebody somewhere out there willing to do something for somebody sometime.
Yeah.
So why don't I go looking down by the levee? So then that's when the Robert E. Lee song starts.
Yeah.
But at the end of...
And that had been Burt Williams, like his signature piece was Nobody.
Yes, yeah. That's right. Mm-hmm. And then by the end of the performance by Ben, he says, well, if there's nobody out there willing to do something, anything for me now, then I'm not going to do anything for anybody.
Yeah.
So it's a kind of, to me, like it said something about, hey, we're all together, right? And then at the end, he's like, well, if nobody's going to look out for me, I'm not going to look out for anybody.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You know, and there's some aspects of that kind of just reminded me of Ronald Reagan's idea of what capitalism is about. Like, mm-hmm. each person gets their own thing, and you can participate if you can play, you know.
Yeah.
And I had taken that as another sign that this was a kind of story that needed to be told in a cyclical way. Mm-hmm. Again, you know, it was the way to push the blackface out of the middle of the story because, you know, blackface is like many other kinds of symbols that are so deeply entangled with emotion, like you can't get an objective distance to it. You know, like For some people, that's a swastika. For some, it's a burning cross. You know, yeah. For others, you know, it could be, you know, somebody screaming fag or something like that, right?
Yeah.
Out of a window when they're driving by. It's like it just gets you.
Mm-hmm.
And blackface is like that. It's one of those things where people immediately find themselves feeling like they need to judge it somehow.
Yeah.
And I thought the best way to talk about the blackface aspect of the performance was to, you know, just make it one other element
mm-hmm.
of the show so that you can see it more clearly for what it is, right? So it's like this idea of looking at stars in the sky, like astronomers say, mm-hmm. you know, the best way to observe a star in the sky is to look at it in your peripheral vision.
Yeah.
Because when you stare at it directly, it shines so bright that it, you mm-hmm. know, it blurs it.
Yeah. So that in some ways, I mean, I think to, you know, go back to this idea of like the triple chronology or the multiple temporalities of the piece, I mean, it's dealing with three separate moments. And maybe one of the things that, you know, makes blackface so fraught is that it's simultaneously something that is very immediate and very vivid. You know, when you see it, there's this kind of charge to it, but it's also like you're being dragged back to another moment in time. You know, it's like the kind of the eruption of the past, a very yes. unwanted past into yes. the present, right?
Yeah.
And it sounds like what you're saying is that the performance is a way to try to negotiate that so that to keep that at bay, like that kind of the pastness of it, to leave it there somehow.
Yeah, so you can recognize the humanity in mm-hmm. it. I mean, yeah. I have seen, you know, another show actually, Neighbors, that mm-hmm. My friend Nataki Garrett had directed.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's about a family of minstrels that moves into like a middle class neighborhood, I think like in Hartford, Connecticut, next to a biracial family, a black husband and a white wife, and they have a little girl.
Mm-hmm.
And he's looking out the window and just like he, you know, just blurts out the word niggers. You know, the black dude says that, and his wife looks at him and goes, "What? Well, what did you say?" He goes, "Well, nothing." You know, but even like watching those performers on that stage,
mm-hmm.
like they were frightening.
Mm-hmm.
But I think part of the reason why they were frightening is because they're like they are hyper, like hyper stylized humans. Like they're there to accentuate the shape of the eyes, the shape of the mouth,
mm-hmm.
so that you can see it from 25 feet away.
Yeah.
If you're in a theater. Uh-huh. Right? They're super accentuated features of the human face into caricature, right? That's what a caricature is.
Yeah.
You know. So when you experience that up close,
mm-hmm.
you know, you can't read the eyes. It's the same reason why we find people in any mask.
Yeah,
because you can't tell where they're going. You know, mm-hmm. you don't know if they're coming at you. You don't know what their intentions are.
Yeah,
and you know, since in this country we conflate criminality with poverty and criminality in particular to the black poor,
mm-hmm.
You know, it has a kind of a kind of resonance that is not exactly about 1920.
Yeah.
But I mean, I know we're going to have to wrap this up, but one of the things that I wanted to mention was that the live performance, mm-hmm. We will be doing that here in LA.
Oh, you will?
In the beginning of June.
Okay.
And I'm actually going to do it at my gallery, at Suzanne Vilmetter Los Angeles Projects.
Okay.
We're hoping to open on June 3rd, but it might be a week earlier or later.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to happen in conjunction with an exhibition. So I'll be making new drawings and paintings and sculptures. But one of the things about being an artist who you know, directs theater is that
mm-hmm.
you can bring these two worlds together and they have a really interesting relationship with each other. So when it's in the daytime, it'll be an installation. And when it's the nighttime, it'll be a theater.
Yeah.
I hope that, you know, your listeners, you know, now and in the future, we'll come and see the show as we're trying to travel it across the United States.
Yeah. So it's something, in other words, it's a piece that it's not that you stage the initial performance and that's it. You're still staging the performance, and then there's also this installation format of it now.
That's right.
Okay. And at LACMA, then this will it be like the fourth or fifth time that you've shown that?
The film, yeah, in different parts of the country in Europe, yeah. I have shown it one other time here publicly in Los Angeles,
USC,
at
right?
USC. Mm-hmm. And now on the occasion of a counter inaugural event.
Yeah.
So what audiences will be seeing, experiencing is a film that is not a documentary of the play, but it's actually shot to bring you inside of the play. So you really are, it's a real movie. It's a real narrative film, and mm-hmm. you're inside of that, inside of that event.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see how you translate that experience of kind of being, in some ways, the subject of the piece from the stage to, you know, to the screen, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to the Q&A afterwards, and mm-hmm. you know, hearing what people think and how people were feeling about just this moment that we're in, where, yeah. you know, Ben Vereen, you know, me, and, you know, this kind of post-Obama era, and this, you know, whatever this Donald Trump era will be, you know, many of us are scared, we're frustrated, we're angry. Mm-hmm. And we feel a bit lost. So this is a time for us to come together and kind of voice that and, you know, get some sense of where we can go.
Yeah. Well, I think it'll be really kind of powerful to see it on next Friday at LACMA. So again, for, you know, people who are interested, Edgar Arsenault's Until will be screening Friday, January 20th. LACMA at 7:30. You were saying show up about 7.
You can get a seat. It's free and it's open to the public.
And there'll be a Q&A with you after.
There's a Q&A after. And the film runs 50 minutes.
Okay. So I'm really looking forward to seeing the film. And then in June, on June 3rd, you'll be performing the...
Performing it live.
Yeah,
in LA, yeah.
Okay. So Edgar, thank you so much for coming on to Performance Now. And... see you, I guess, next week.
Yeah, and if you guys want to see more, check out my website, studioedgararsenault.com, and see you out there.